From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And after his meeting in Mexico yesterday and his speech in Phoenix last night, this morning, Donald Trump was speaking to the American Legion Convention in Cincinnati and talked about his meeting with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto yesterday.
We agreed in the meeting on the need to stop the illegal flow of guns, drugs, cash, and people across the border, and to take out the cartels, have to get rid of those cartels, and we have to do it quickly. Our country is being poisoned. Our country is being poisoned.
Well, joining us now is NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Jeremy.
And a lot to talk about. In fact, a lot of Trump speeches to talk about. And let's start with what happened last night in Phoenix. After a couple of weeks about people talking about a potential softening on his immigration stance, I watched the speech last night. It didn't sound like a softening at all. In fact, he reiterated that he wanted to deport all of the people who are in the country illegally.
Yes, every last one, no matter how many that may be, and no matter how long they may have been here or what they may have been doing, they all have to go, he said. Anyone arrested for any reason would be deported immediately, and others would be able to, so let's say, self-deport, as Mitt Romney used to say. And otherwise, if they don't, once the things have stabilized, to use Donald Trump's phrase, those are his words, then a deportation task force would round up all the people still in the country illegally and send them to their country of origin from which they could apply for reentry someday.
And Mitt Romney, we remember, was basically laughed off the stage for saying self-deport because it sounded so unreasonable, like nobody would ever actually do that. But Donald Trump seems to think that it's a good idea to continue to talk about this.
Well, what we're feeling today, really, Jeremy, is a kind of whiplash. If you picked up on Trump yesterday in the daylight hours, you saw him in Mexico City looking rather presidential and dominating the actual Mexican president, who was quite deferential to him, at least in public, yesterday. It looked like the perfect setup for Trump to then make his much-awaited speech, ending all the back and forth about softening or becoming more humane in his immigration stance. And if he was going to be humane, this was a great chance to broaden his appeal. But instead, as we saw, you really had to see it to believe it, he went to the opposite extreme.
And what about that meeting with the Mexican president, Enrique Peña Nieto? There was this disagreement about whether this subject of Mexico paying for Trump's border wall was brought up. The Trump campaign, well, Trump in the press conference said they didn't talk about it. And then afterwards, Peña Nieto said they did. And he said he would never pay for the wall.
And Donald Trump as much as acknowledged that Peña Nieto had told him no way Mexico was paying for the wall. In Phoenix last night, he said Mexico would pay and 100% of the cost. They just don't know it yet. That was the way he put it. So he clearly heard what the Mexican president was telling him, but he apparently did not respond to it. So there wasn't a discussion. And his campaign says that's what he meant when he said they had not discussed it.
Meanwhile, the event in Mexico, the event in Phoenix, this morning's event in Cleveland, all carried live on cable television. Trump seems to have taken back the media spotlight.
He has. And, you know, the great irony here is that no candidate for president has ever benefited more from that media spotlight than Donald Trump. He also makes a certain amount of hay off of bashing the media, the lying media, as he calls us. So he has it both ways. And that's really been a major key to his success.
Ron, Trump and Clinton will be on the same stage on Wednesday at a forum in New York. And then the debates start on September 26th. Can't believe it. Just later this month now. How is the new Trump team post Paul Manafort, the campaign manager who had to leave the campaign? How is it coming together? Are you seeing anything different?
You know, it's almost as though he has a daytime campaign manager, Kellyanne Conway, and a nighttime manager in Steve Bannon. It was very much a Kellyanne Conway kind of production yesterday in Mexico City, but very much a Steve Bannon mind meld. This is the fellow who's been the publisher of Breitbart.com, the voice of the alt-right, as he calls it. And that seemed like a mind meld with Steve Bannon that we heard last night in Phoenix. So the two of them continue to contend, and the campaign continues to reflect both points of view.
And what about Hillary Clinton? Where is she at this point? We know she's been doing some fundraisers, but she's not in the media spotlight. Is that by design?
to some degree it is. She has had some degree of success, at least her campaign feels, in flying a little below the radar, letting that spotlight be on Donald Trump. That has exposed some things about Donald Trump that have not gone down well with the public in general. And you could almost compare it to the kind of strategy that the late great boxer Muhammad Ali used to pursue sometimes, what they call the rope-a-dope strategy. Mm. You let your opponent, or opponents in this case, punch themselves out and weaken themselves over time and essentially let them dictate the pace, but eventually exhaust themselves.
NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, let's go back to Donald Trump's visit to Mexico. In Mexico, commentators have been excoriating their president for inviting Trump in the first place for what would be perceived as a state visit, and then for seeming to appease Trump, as one analyst said, a capitulation along the lines of Neville Chamberlain before World War II. Esteban Iades is editor of the magazine Nexos. He joins us by Skype from Mexico City. Esteban, you called this the most painful day in the history of the Mexican presidency.
It was humiliating. In the last 50 years, a Mexican president has not humiliated himself on Mexican soil this way. He made Donald Trump look presidential, which I think is incredibly hard to do. He gave him the royal treatment. He gave him a podium. They stood side by side in Los Pinos, which is the equivalent of the White House. And he was very deferential to him. In the end, he ended up saying that whatever Donald Trump said about Mexico in the first place, that saying that we were rapists, that we're not sending our best people, that we're responsible for many felonies in the United States, that we just misunderstood him, that we didn't really understand what Donald Trump was saying, and that maybe we should forgive him because he wasn't as harsh as we thought he was in the first place.
Well, you're talking about what President Nieto said as he stood with Donald Trump, that perhaps Donald Trump was just misunderstood. But then Donald Trump went and launched a press conference, which your president didn't seem to be prepared for, in which Donald Trump said that the topic of the wall had come up, payment would be discussed later. Your president had to tweet out that, in fact, he told Donald Trump clearly in their private meeting that Mexico would not pay.
I'm ashamed to say this, but my president was caught off guard. I mean, when Donald Trump launched his impromptu press conference in Los Pinos, the president wasn't ready at all to field questions. And Trump, who's an expert in doing that, I mean, he comes from reality television. He not only jumped in, he told which reporters to ask questions. So he jumped in ahead of Peña Nieto. He mentioned the wall. And while Peña was actually waiting for the translation in his earpiece, Trump was already talking about the wall. So he was caught so off guard that he actually had to tweet after the conference that he was very emphatic that they didn't even really talk about the wall, that he wasn't going to pay for the wall.
Well, so what happens now? Your previous presidents, like Vicente Fox, are saying that your sitting president was duped by an American presidential candidate.
Yeah, everyone. Well, the New York Times editorial board this morning actually called this a humiliation. Mexican newspapers, which are usually very pro-president, one of them was saying that we were used, that Trump used Peña Nieto. What happens now today is actually the State of the Union here in Mexico City. It's the fourth State of the Union, and Peña is supposed to relaunch his presidency. You have to remember that Peña Nieto's approval rating is hovering around 23% for the past year. So he was hoping that the State of the Union this year would catapult him forward, that he would actually promise some new things, get some new things done. And the slogan for the State of the Union was, "People don't talk about the good things here in Mexico, so let's talk about the good things." But when you have Donald Trump coming in, surprisingly, the day before the State of the Union and treating the president this way and actually bringing up the wall in Mexico City, it's very difficult in Mexico to talk about the good things that the government is doing.
Well, in fact, this is what we're hearing that some Mexicans wanted your president to talk about last night, the fact that, in fact, the economy is doing relatively well. There are fewer people crossing the border. And none of that was brought up. Also, did you want to hear your president say something in front of Donald Trump about the way Donald Trump characterized Mexicans?
Definitely. I mean, there's this movie called Love Actually, which is a 12, 13-year-old movie in which Hugh Grant plays the prime minister of Britain, and the American president, played by Billy Bob Thornton, shows up.
Great movie.
Great movie. They give this press conference, and Hugh Grant stands up for Britain. We were actually hoping that maybe this time President Peña Nieto would stand up for Mexicans. But in the end, he gave this very bland speech talking about platitudes, talking about regional security, giving facts, figures. But it wasn't really, the tone was very subdued. It didn't really seem like he was actually trying to confront Donald Trump. even though later on at night he gave a primetime interview with Mexico's top newscast, and he was saying that to him this was a confrontation, but no Mexican, only the Mexicans that are part of the government, actually saw a confrontation in the first place. What we saw was a president who didn't know how to speak to Donald Trump, who was completely humiliated by him, and who now faces a very big crisis.
And what's the thinking in Mexico about, as far as you can tell, about what this might mean politically on both sides of the border?
Politically here in Mexico, the president has become a lame duck because he's lost the support even of the media. And what does this mean for Donald Trump? Well, sadly, some people were saying here yesterday that it would be completely even more humiliating if Donald Trump ended up winning the election. And the pivotal moment was when he came here to Mexico and proved he was presidential. If Mexico actually does help Donald Trump get elected, it's going to be a major catastrophe.
Esteban Iades, editor of Nexos. Thank you, Esteban. He talked to us from Mexico City.
There's a new opioid addiction treatment on the market. It's an implant, four little sticks that are inserted into a patient's arm and deliver a constant low dose of medication. Experts say it could be a game changer for people dependent on opioid addiction medication. But doctors across the country are encountering some challenges in learning to administer the drug. Karen Shakurji of WXXI in Rochester, New York, reports.
First of the very important sterilization steps, okay? Alcohol pad, alcohol wipe, get all that dirt and oil off.
In a big hotel conference room in Times Square, New York, six doctors are huddled around a greasy hunk of pork.
And I'm going to just mark where my incision site is going to be.
They're watching another doctor dot four short blue lines on the tenderloin.
If you can do it well on the pork, you can easily do it in the person.
The FDA approved Probufene in May with a caveat. Because physicians who treat addiction don't necessarily have experience with surgery, they need to be certified before they can either implant or prescribe the treatment. Braeburn, the pharmaceutical company selling it, has been running these sessions across the country.
And I'm going to insert the implant. And now, just like loading a cannon, advance the obturator. Just until that line, you see that? Until that line lines up.
Probufene is unlike any other addiction treatment on the market. It lasts for 6 months at a time and can't be lost, stolen, or sold in the way other meds like Suboxone can. Ella Lears treats substance abuse patients at a center in Manhattan.
They don't have to be dependent on taking something every day, taking medication every day. It takes the choice out of that, which can help people protect them from themselves.
In a recent study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, researchers said patients were less likely to relapse with the implant compared to an under-the-tongue version of the same drug. But with this new treatment comes a whole new system for doctors to navigate.
If you're implanting something that can be there for 6 months, you want to make sure patients are still coming in to get the other types of support that they could use because of their addiction issues.
For now, doctors need to buy the Probufene kits, which cost almost $5,000, and then bill patients or insurance companies. Some insurance companies have pre-approved coverage for the kits, but not for the procedure. They've found it's not medically necessary. Also essential, a sterile room. Gloria Bachevitz is the head of addiction psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center.
Now, with Probufene, we have to take it up to a whole different level because we have to have either agreements with implanters or a room where we can implant. We have to get the equipment. There will be a lot more to do.
So far, about 2,400 practitioners have been certified. 27 of them have actually implanted patients. Scott Jernigan was in recovery for almost a year taking another medication when he signed up for the Probufene clinical trial. It made a huge difference.
Because that meant I didn't have to keep going to the doctor every week. That meant I didn't have to go to the pharmacy every week. That meant that I could become more of what my normal is going to be.
And maybe most important, he didn't have to take a daily dose of meds anymore or worry about what might happen if he forgot them.
When I say I hope I brought my set medicine, it means, oh, hey, I was a drug addict. I got this medicine to make me feel better. And if I don't take it, you're going to see a blithering mess in front of you here in another 24 hours.
Back at the training session in Manhattan, Dr. Ella Lears passed the porking test. She says some of her patients have already asked when they can get the implant.
So maybe not next week, but hopefully in the next couple of months.
Braeburn says that so far, dozens of patients have received the implant. The company will continue running training sessions for physicians this summer. For Here and Now, I'm Karen Chakurji.
And Karen's story was produced in collaboration with Side Effects Public Media.
Well, ads, lots of them, are starting to run and bring attention to a district race in Utah. So let's shine a light as well in our district tracker. Let's go to Utah's 4th Congressional District. Utah's fascinating this year. It's a reliably red state. The majority of Mormons are Republicans. But this year, many in the state, including former GOP nominee Mitt Romney, are balking at Donald Trump's coarse language and his comments on freedom of religion and Muslims. Terry Gilday is news director at KUER in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Robin.
Well, in this 4th district, you've got the Republican incumbent, Mia Love, who made a big splash when she won, a black Republican female in a very white state, born Catholic, converted to Mormon. Her challenger, the Democrat Doug Owens, a Mormon as well. And they faced each other in 2014 when Love won. So start with Congresswoman Mia Love. Tell us more about her.
Well, Love's story is really quite fascinating. She, as you said, grew up Catholic in Connecticut. She met a Mormon missionary, Jason Love, I think around the time that she was in college. The two fell in love. They got married. She converted to the Mormon faith and came to Utah and settled in a small town about 40 miles south of Salt Lake City called Saratoga Springs. She was elected to the city council and then elected mayor, and it's from that platform that she launched her congressional bid, her first one in 2012, and she took on Democrat Jim Matheson.
And then one, as we said, in 2014, becoming the first black female Republican in Congress. Let's listen to a little of an ad that Mia Love has started airing.
About people.
Mia has worked very hard to protect jobs in Utah and the country.
She cares about every student. She cares about making sure our schools have local control.
Mia is fighting for us and all veterans' families.
I usually vote Democrat, but this year I'm voting for Mia Love.
I support
Well, and
Mia
Terry
Love.
Gilday, that's the ad, but how are people there feeling about how she's represented them?
A little mixed, Robin. There are some in the district who are quite satisfied with how she's represented them. Others are ready for a change. A poll released just a year into her term from a group called UtahPolicy.com showed that 33% of voters in the district were not satisfied with how Love was representing them, but 51% were satisfied. So it, again, is a district that's definitely in contention this year in this election cycle.
Well, and that's maybe why Democrat Doug Owens is stepping up again, because as we said, they faced each other in 2014. He lost. And here's a bit of his new ad from his camp telling of his great-grandfather's trek with the Mormons as they came to Utah.
Imagine walking 1,000 miles barefoot across the open plains.
My great-grandfather did just that, but he didn't do it alone. He made the journey with hundreds of other pioneers who looked after each other and worked together to build our state. That's still how we get things done in Utah, but the story in Washington is different.
Terry Gilday, tell us a little bit more about him, Doug Owens.
Well, Doug Owens' father, Wayne Owens, was a Democrat who served in the U.S. House in Utah's 2nd District at the time. He served a couple of different times in the 70s and the 80s. Doug himself is a Yale Law School grad. He's a business defense attorney in Utah and looks to espouse a lot of the values that his father espoused in Congress. He's hoping to follow in his father's footsteps in Congress. But he'll have a tough road against Love. He lost the race in 2014 by about 7,500 votes. But he's hoping this year that the presence of Donald Trump on the Republican ticket might sway some Republicans in his district to vote for him instead of Love.
Well, and that's the talk, that something crazy might happen in Utah. Because so many Mormons there have rejected, Mormon Republicans have rejected Donald Trump, not just because of his language about religious faith, very sensitive issue to the once very persecuted Mormons, but also about his language in general, his profanities. What's your sense of the down-ballot effect of Donald Trump?
Well, you know, Mitt Romney made a very important speech in Utah in May where he essentially called Donald Trump a fraud. It was a speech that he made here at the University of Utah at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. And really, he cast Donald Trump as the worst choice for the Republican Party as a candidate. And I think that voters, especially Mormon voters, agree with Romney on that. You know, there are lots of things about Donald Trump that are not attractive to Mormon voters, but you touched on it a little bit. I think that when Donald Trump talks about banning Muslims from the country or building a wall to keep Mexican immigrants out, those are the kinds of things that resonate a lot with Mormon voters. They were a group historically that has endured a lot of organized persecution, and that kind of stuff really resonates with them. Yeah. So I think that those factors, among some others, will be ones that that move Mormon voters away from Trump.
Well, and Mia Love seems to be aware of that, your opinion, because you got Senator Orrin Hatch and Mia Love's three House colleagues from Utah, Representatives Rob Bishop, Jason Chaffetz, and Chris Stewart, all signing a letter urging Republicans to vote for Donald Trump and Mike Pence for many reasons, including Supreme Court nominees. She did not sign that.
She did not, and she's very aware of the distaste for Donald Trump, and she's withholding her support until she says she finds out more about what a potential President Trump and Vice President Pence mean for the country, especially for Utah residents. So we'll see what happens, but the push towards supporting Donald Trump changes every day in Utah. Our governor, Governor Gary Herbert, is supporting Trump, basically saying that he supports Mike Pence and that Mike Pence is a friend of his. But our lieutenant governor, Spencer Cox, will not support Trump. So there's still quite a bit of division. There's a call among Republicans to rally behind the nominee. But there are others, including Mia Love, who are withholding that support for the time being.
Terry Gilday, news director at KUER in Salt Lake City, Utah. Going to be fascinating to watch this fourth congressional district race there in that state. Terry, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, in Florida, people are bracing for Tropical Storm Hermine, which is expected to make landfall tonight as a Category 1 hurricane. It's Florida's first in a decade. The storm is already showing 65-mile-per-hour winds this morning, and it is gaining. Warnings issued along the state's Gulf Coast and up to South Carolina. Meanwhile, the first major hurricane of 2016, that would be Gaston, is moving east over the Atlantic toward the Azores. And in Hawaii, warnings were discontinued after Tropical Storm Madeline continued to recede just in time for Hurricane Lester, which is right behind and could hit this holiday weekend.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron. Blue Apron knows that incredible ingredients make incredible meals, so they follow the highest quality standards and deliver recipes along with just the right amount of ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. New recipes are created each week by Blue Apron's culinary team, so you can customize your recipes each week. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. There's no weekly commitment, so pick what you want at blueapron.com/here.
There's been some excitement this week at the U.S. Open.
Ryan Harrison, though, into the third round at the U.S. Open. First time in a major. He's gone this far through the qualifiers.
That's American Ryan Harrison beating out fifth-seeded Milos Raonic of Canada. Rafael Nadal also won yesterday. Both Andy Murray and Serena Williams are playing today. But a big name in the men's bracket is missing. Roger Federer, who holds the record for Grand Slam titles, is out with a knee injury. He has my empathy. Sports commentator John Bacon is here from Here Now contributor Michigan Radio. Hi, John.
Hello, Robin.
So Federer sitting it out, Novak Djokovic playing, but with a wrist injury. Nadal's been plagued by injuries. Everyone's saying we're seeing the end of an era here.
It's getting close. Not quite the end, Robin, but the beginning of the end, perhaps. And it's kind of a shame because this is the big four, as you know. Kind of like the three tenors. Even if you're not a tennis fan, this is the golden era of tennis. And these guys are getting near the end.
Well, and the fourth being Andy Murray?
That is correct. He's the least heralded of the four, I would say. But he's 29 years old, and currently he's the healthiest, so he might get the last laugh.
Well, he certainly did. I mean, a couple weeks ago, we were thinking that so many of the top players are coming into the U.S. Open having been very embarrassed at the Olympics.
And embarrassed the last 13 years, really, Robin. So it's not been a good decade. The last time an American won a major in tennis is Andy Roddick in 2003, exactly 13 years ago. So that's not a good run.
No, but even Novak Djokovic, I mean, they didn't do well in the Olympics. So maybe something to prove here. We heard sound at the top of American Ryan Harrison's upset. American John Isner is also still in. Madison Keys had an easy win. Is there, you know, an upswing maybe for American tennis going on?
I would say a nominal yes, Robin, based on my dad's old theory, which is when you're on the floor, you can't fall out of bed. So I think the future looks brighter than the present, but there's still a few years away, I think. But yeah. Jack Sock is an up-and-comer. Steve Johnson also is. And, of course, you always have Serena Williams.
Well, and scan the horizon for us from all countries. Who else should we, if we're just tuning in and thinking, okay, let's get to the U.S. Open, who should we be looking for?
Well, the guy just got knocked out, actually.
Oh.
Milos Raonic might be the next of the big four guys. Canadian, of course, which you don't see very often. He's got a very strong serve, and he's got a very bright future ahead of him. I would say Pablo Carreña Busta, a 22-year-old Spaniard, might be following in Nadal's footsteps. And a guy from Australia, a cocky, loud guy named Bernard Tomic, would be interesting to watch as well.
Yeah. So what do you think? I mean, we just look quickly at the future of tennis before we glance at another sport real quick. But, you know, you see a golden era forming?
Maybe, but man, this one is probably the last you're going to see in my lifetime, and I'm not a kid, I grant you, but four guys together. The last time we saw anything like this was Borg, McEnroe, and of course Connors back in the 70s and 80s, Ilya Nastasi, if you guys like that.
Well, not to mention
these
now,
four, by the way, they've won 42 of the last 46 majors. You never have seen that in the history of the sport.
We're also watching the Williams sisters, so I mean, there's women too that are, but just real
Absolutely.
Quick, this is going to be like a yes or no. College football season starting, big question as it seems every year it is. Can anyone beat Alabama?
Only Alabama can beat Alabama. How's that?
Okay, that's a no.
they don't rebuild, they reload. That's what they're doing.
Well, we're going to hear from other schools. So bring it. Sports commentator John Bacon, thanks as always.
Robin, always a pleasure.
This holiday weekend, the Discovery Channel premieres a miniseries called Harley and the Davidsons, about the founding of the iconic motorcycle company Harley-Davidson. The miniseries begins in early 20th century Wisconsin. Robert Arameo plays Bill Harley, an engineer who teams up with Arthur and Walter Davidson to explore the idea of putting an engine on a bike. They attract a lot of attention.
I saw Walter Davidson flying through town on your revolutionary contraption?
Actually, it's our contraption. The motorcycle. We all built it. Together.
So, when do I get to see this motorcycle?
Walter has it. Probably driving it across the State House lawn.
Have you ridden it yet?
Yeah.
What's it like?
Like an explosion between your legs.
Excuse me?
I mean, it's fast.
A scene from the new Discovery Channel miniseries, Harley and the Davidsons, and Robert Arameo joins us to talk about it. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, man. It's good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. And by the way, for our listeners, you were born and raised in Hull, England, before coming to Juilliard in New York to study theater. How familiar were you with Harley-Davidson motorcycles before you made this miniseries?
I was familiar in a sense of its, perhaps one could say, like its merchandising or its culture. But in terms of the specifics of the company and certainly the origins of the company, I had absolutely no idea. You know, I and a few of my fellow castmates thought that the company was started by somebody called Harley Davidson, which obviously I found to be very not true indeed.
Well, and in fact, your character is named Bill Harley. He was one of the engineers behind all this. Tell us about him and what you learned about him as you did this.
Well, I always sort of relish the opportunity to talk about Bill Harley and his life's achievements because, you know, his achievements are so vast. When he died, the number of patents to his name are just, you know, it's something like 90. You know, he personally was such an incredible man. And, you know, one of the things that was very important to me was to honour the character that we were creating whilst also giving the Bill Harley that I read about and loved a just defence. Do you know what I mean? Somebody who is... you know, one thing that was always said about the, you know, real life Bill was that he was always such a lovely man. He treated everybody equally and he was incredibly intelligent and integral to the company. Since he was, you know, the engineer, he's the brains of the operation. And I think our iteration of Bill is quite a sensitive man, a vulnerable man. But what I love so much about him is he's a creative, he's an artist, you know. But at the beginning of the story, he has all of this stuff, all of this creative talent inside of him, but he has no outlet to express it. And I think that's what's so amazing about the relationships between the three characters, that they give him an outlet, something he can channel his ideas into. But for Bill Harley, it started with drawing. It didn't start with drawing motorcycles. Do you know what I mean? It started with simply, you know, expressing himself through drawing, and then it became focused primarily on engines and motorcycles later. But for him, it was an artistic journey first.
Well, and as you portray him, he was a shy guy.
Very much so, yeah. You know, I think Bill's an island. He's a very introverted man. His outlet is the page. It's drawing, it's creating, it's engineering and building the engine, you know. And that's all, I think, it's solo, you know. That's something that one does on one's own.
How difficult is it for you when you're playing a character like this to do an American accent throughout the entire thing?
Well, I mean, I've sort of worked exclusively in American dialects whilst I was at school. You know,
you mean different dialects, like learning how to speak with a Southern accent or
yeah,
Western
man.
Or Northern.
Yeah, I mean,
whatever.
if the play when I was at school required that, I think that one important thing when thinking about dialects is that if you commit to a certain dialect, if you commit to that this is the way that this person speaks, you know, then I don't think dialect should be a problem because you're not thinking about dialect. You're thinking about what's more important than dialect, which is intention or what's going on in a certain moment. So, yeah, I think, that would be my answer, I think.
Is it a different way of acting when you're doing an accent versus when you're just speaking in your normal accent?
Yes, I think it is. And, you know, one thing that was very important for me was to stay in the dialect as much as I could because I think that the dialect put, you know, the way you choose to place your voice when doing a dialect is usually conducive to the character that you're playing, you know, i.e. with Bill, he's a very, as I've said, you know, a very sensitive and vulnerable man. And I think where I chose to place his voice is it put me in quite a vulnerable place. And I think that's good when playing somebody, you know, who that is true for.
Watching this miniseries reminded us what a crazy idea this was in the first place to strap an engine onto a bicycle. And at the beginning, we even see an engine blowing up because the parts weren't machined properly. It gives you a greater appreciation of motorcycles.
Yes, it certainly does. And I think the sort of origins of the motorcycle itself, you know, we weren't the only company, you know, Harley-Davidson was not the only company doing this, you know, and everyone was sort of coming from the same place. And I think... You know, what's cool about our story is, yes, you know, Bill knows what he wants. He knows what he needs to be able to make the bike, but they have to work with what they've got. And, you know, that's why you get things like pistons exploding out of the top of crankcases and stuff. You know, it's just like, you know, that's because they had to work with what they had at their disposal.
Do you think of the motorcycle as an American icon? And especially after doing this miniseries, do you think that it is?
I do, yeah, I do. I think the story of Harley Davidson, it almost exemplifies the American dream in terms of the adversity that one sort of has to overcome. You know, and I think that one thing that was very apparent to me when I was doing my research was the, you know, a culture or, you know, a way of life that exists around a Harley Davidson that felt very, very in the forefront when I was watching documentaries or speaking to people. It definitely feels to me a very, you know, American icon in terms of the machine itself. Yeah, absolutely.
And did you get a sense of why they have to be so loud?
Yeah, man. I mean, come on. It's cool. It's, you know, it's like it's such a distinctive sound, you know. And I think it's one of the, you know, characteristic signs of a Harley Davidson. You hear it before you see it.
Well, I have to ask you, because our audience will want to know, that you, they may have seen on another program before, you were in Game of Thrones. In season 6, you play the young Ned Stark. We read that you were a big fan of the show even before you were asked to play the role. What was it like to be in that?
A dream, man. An absolute dream. I have Game of Thrones is sort of the only thing that I watch, really. It's probably at the minute my favorite story. And Ned was always my favorite character. And what I like so much about Thrones, they're using actors from all over my country, do you know what I mean? And their voices are getting heard, you know, the way that a voice sounds or is getting heard because it's on one of the biggest shows in the world, do you know what I mean? And I always loved that. I always loved hearing my dialect on a show that big. Really made me feel quite proud, you know. So it was it's a crazy story. I feel incredibly... honoured to have been a part of it and to have been a part that is advancing the story in such a great way and highlighting something that to many people was otherwise unknown, really, and a great sort of insight into the mythology. So I got to sort of like get the, you know, I had a great fight scene, which is something that, you know, Thrones is famous for, and then I had a great, you know, perhaps a more emotive scene to play as well. So it was like I had sort of a slice of both, but it maintained its romanticism and its mysticism for me in this great way.
And are you recognized for that now? I can't imagine once you're on something like Game of Thrones that, you know, people see you on the street, even if you're not a huge character on the show, that's what they recognize you for.
Yeah, you know, I guess so, yeah. And it's, you know, it's really lovely. I mean, what was so cool about my scene was that it was almost for the book readers, which was really cool. You know, it's unveiling something that people have wanted to be expressed for years and years and years. And so to get the chance
to... But that was not in the book, is what you're saying.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's much speculation out there, should we say, you know, R plus L equals J, I think the theory was called. And I think for a lot of people, for that finally to be televised was very, very exciting indeed. And of course, what it means to the story.
I plus L equals J? What is, explain.
It's R plus L equals
R plus L equals J. Okay.
Apparently, I've just been told this. Apparently, it's Rhaegar plus Lyanna equals Jon. So that's the theory. The theory is that Rhaegar and Lyanna Stark were in love, and the product of their love is Jon Snow.
And you said that just like they do, Jon Snow. Okay. Well, Robert Arameo, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, man. It's great to be here. Thank you very much.
And you can catch Robert Arameo on the Discovery Channel miniseries Harley and the Davidsons, which starts this Monday.
The European migrant crisis has been off the radar, but now there's an update and an uptick. This week, thousands of people were rescued in the Mediterranean Sea, trying to cross from North Africa to Europe. Those who survived are arriving at ports in Sicily. Poland's interior minister said yesterday that his country has denied entry to a group of Chechens because Poland is sealing its border to protect it and the rest of Europe from terrorism. And you might remember a few months back, the borders were closed along the Balkans, and a deal was struck between the EU and Turkey, Turkey agreeing to take new migrants arriving in Greece in exchange for Turkey being allowed freer travel within the EU. Well, now Turkey is saying the EU isn't holding up its end of the bargain and hinting that Turkey might not either. And this is all having an impact on Greece. Joining us is Amy Fairbairn. She's with the aid group Mercy Corps. She's with us on Skype from Athens. Amy, welcome. And tell us what you've been seeing this week as far as refugees coming to Greece.
Well, hi, Robin, and thank you very much for having me. So I've spent the last week traveling with our teams who are dispersed across Greece. So that means on the islands, so the islands of Leros, Lesvos and Kos, Ioannina in northwest Greece, and Athens and the surrounds as well. What we've been seeing over the last week and what our field teams have been seeing for months is a population of people that are really stuck in limbo. They were trapped in Greece because they haven't been able to move forward. Because the borders are now closed. Many of them arrived just before or just after the EU-Turkey deal came into effect in March. And essentially, they're a no man's land. They don't know where they're going to go and what they're going to do next.
Yeah, but are you also seeing, as we're reading, maybe a slight uptick this week with maybe migrants thinking that the EU-Turkey deal is going to collapse? We're seeing reports of migrants arriving from Turkey. So obviously they're able to travel through. And is there a concern that more will think they can if Turkey is going to drag its feet on turning them back?
That's a very good point, Robin. And yes, we have seen in the last couple of weeks, there have been slight increases in the numbers of refugees arriving on the islands, certainly. Lesvos is seeing about 100 refugees arriving every day at the moment. So if you look at the figures, we're about 300,000 for this year alone, which have come into southern Europe. What I think is really important as well for people to know, because this crisis has dropped off the media radar, is that more people have died crossing the Mediterranean Sea this year than at the same time last year. So, yes, we're still seeing people come across. We're still seeing people dying, unfortunately. And, yes, with the uncertainty with what's going to happen with the EU-Turkey deal and the Turkey's own internal politics at the moment, there's certainly a understanding, a acknowledgement that this could affect numbers.
And just to remind people, you say it's about 100 a day migrants arriving, but it was at 1.50. Which was way down from the height, which was 6,000 a day, which is still hard to wrap your head around. So what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think there's many things that could happen. We're fearful for the numbers to increase as well. We're fearful for winter to come. I mean, at the moment, I'm sitting in Athens and at 36 degrees Celsius, but in a couple of months, it's going to be much colder. I was at a camp in northwest Greece yesterday, which is 1,200 meters above sea level. It regularly gets below zero there in the wintertime. So what we're seeing is potentially, we could see an increase in refugees coming across the water in the next couple of months. We are also going to see a population that are static that need help with winterization as well.
Well, this comes as Greece has its own economic problems. Where are they? Are the refugees all in camps? We're reading about converted old abandoned aluminum factories. Where are they living?
It's a bit of both, to be honest. So the camps that I've seen over the last few days, some are tented camps, as you would imagine. I think most of us have the idea of a tented refugees camp. Some of them are sort of in containers. Some are in the one I saw yesterday, it was in a dilapidated old building that used to be an orphanage, where people are living in tents in the building, which leaks. It doesn't have electricity, hot water, that type of thing. And then we've got squats in Athens as well. So buildings which have been abandoned for a number of years that refugees are living in now.
Amy, and how many are there in Greece?
There's around 57,000 static in Greece, registered in Greece at the moment. Yeah. So, I mean, I think we all need to bear in mind the scale of this crisis. So we've got a sort of a microcosm in Greece of 57,000 static people who are trapped between borders, essentially. But then you've got millions of people in the Middle East who also need support, who have been fleeing the Syrian war and other countries of fragility. Turkey alone is hosting 3 million refugees.
Amy Fairbairn with Mercy Corps, speaking to us by Skype from Athens. We'll link you to their website if you want to help. Amy, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And we wondered if that picture of that little boy drowned, washed up on the shore, would make a difference. It didn't.